With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
Looking at the rain, feeling the pain of love lost running through my brain. This is Carefree Highway Revisited, the show that celebrates Gordon Lightfoot's music song by song, a proud member of the That's Not Canon podcast network. I'm your host, Mike Messner, and with me today is a fellow Lightfoot fan making his second appearance on the show from Hornby Island, British Columbia, John McLaughlin. John, welcome back to Carefree Highway Revisited.
Oh, thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
Now, you were on what was almost our premiere show, and you and I talked about Canadian Railroad Trilogy, and that was a really informative episode that we had on a very historical song. And today we're going to be looking at Looking at the Rain, which is from the Don Quixote album of 1972. Now, why did you in particular want to talk about this one this week?
Well, it's off of my favorite album of them all. I mean, there's many, but this one I particularly love. And it came out when I was only about 12 years old. The song itself has taken new meaning as time has gone by. And it's a couple of times in my life, it has had a very interesting impact on me. And I could relate to it a lot, which I think probably many people can.
Yeah. The images that it brings up are of not only the weather, which of course everyone has been through, but the heartbreak that virtually everyone has ever been through. It's just beautifully evocative. I mean, a rainy street on a late fall day, and street, which kind of implies that it's in at least a suburban area, if not an urban area, and then missing someone or pining from someone. Someone online said that it was like being obsessed with someone. We'll talk about that possibility a little later on. You said that you can relate to it. Is there an anecdote or a particular episode in your life that really conjures up this song?
Well, there's two actually, and they're rather personal, but one was when I found out that somebody that I was in love with and very interested in suddenly met someone else and was getting married. And I can still remember it was actually a rainy day. I was at work. I worked in a bookstore. I was young and there was nobody in that morning. It was a dead Monday morning in this bookstore, and the wind was blowing like crazy outside, and this song just came to me. And then the other time was actually, and this is, I've talked to somebody else who had the same experience, but there's not all of the song, but there are aspects of it that are very much like when somebody dies as well. And my best friend died in a plane crash when he was just 28. And there's some similarities in there for this. So it's interesting when you look at it, even from that standpoint, and the rumination that you go through musically, which we'll talk about maybe a little later, is it just rolls around and it is really like ruminating. You know, you can't get it out of your mind. And this person that you want is not there, and you can't get rid of the thought.
Yeah, it is almost a obsessive vicious cycle. I mean, you can't get the train of thought out of your head, and you're looking at something and everything reminds you that you're in this miserable funk. I think we've all gone through that at some point, whether it's the loss of someone that potentially was a mate or the death of someone, things like that. Is there a particular time of day or a setting that you would choose, hey, this is perfect for me to listen to Looking at the Rain?
Sure. Interesting. We're recording this in the middle of November, but it would be November, the leaves rolling around a bit. And yeah, I mean, a dimming part of the day on a Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock when the light starting to go and it's gray and dark outside. Like that's rather depressing, but that's when I think of it.
You know, it's almost identical for me. I think of my teenage years. I lived in London for 6 months when I was in high school. And although I don't recall going through a whole lot of heartbreak, I can just see all of the images, the trees, the wind, the rain, the picture, all of these things. And I was a little homesick, but that's a slightly different feeling from what we're talking about here. And in November, where it tends to be kind of getting cold in England, and actually I was in England when there was actually a hurricane that ripped through the south of England and destroyed Kew Gardens. So I've seen that happen more or less in spades. I also think of Sunday afternoons in particular, where you've had the weekend and now you're realizing you're going back to school, you're going back to a job that you may think is okay, but you're not really, you know, ready to do this. So you don't really want to go back and face the world for whatever reason. So when this was written, Lightfoot was going through the end of his marriage with his first wife, Britta. And I think he has gone on record saying that he really kind of wishes he was able to make it work. And it seems like he has some regrets about not being able to make the marriage work. He misses her, even though he knows that the marriage is irrevocably broken. The marriage is over. If they haven't formally gone through the divorce proceedings, they might as well have. Is there anything you can add to that? Any angle that you have on what was going on with Lightfoot when he wrote this?
I don't have anything more than that, except I've got the book of his lead sheets from this album. It's interesting to look at the copyright dates in it, because of all the songs off of Don Quixote, the dates on all of them is copyright 1972. This one is 1969, which is kind of interesting. So but I think that's about when this was all starting to happen. I can't remember the exact dates. But anyway, it's just kind of interesting that it's a couple of years earlier than the other songs on the album.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, they got married in either 63 or 64, and the marriage lasted 10 years. So maybe even as early as this, he saw that the relationship was beginning to fall apart. But it's interesting that it's 69 when he wrote this, and they don't get divorced until 73. So he's still married, but he's realizing that there's probably some cracks in the relationship that maybe can't be fixed. So let's look at the lyrics a little bit. Looking at the rain, feeling the pain of love lost running through my brain. So he's identifying, as you said earlier, John, this fact that he can't think of anybody or anything except this woman that he's fallen for and that he's lost or is losing. And of course, rain is a melancholy thing in most contexts, and it certainly is here. I don't know any other way that you could portray the rain as being anything other than melancholy.
No, for sure. And I mean, it's interesting that he uses that word, because he uses rain a lot in his songs. He uses it often in the first verse of a few songs, Early Morning Rain, of course. But this one, it's definitely a poetic word to use, that's for sure. But
Rainy Day People was the other one that I thought of, although that's a much more optimistic song than this one. Looking at the wind, watching it spin the leaves along the street, you win. Well, that's the only way you can really see the wind, is when it's blowing something, leaves or trees or branches or objects. But then he ends that line by saying, you win. And that implies that if you win, she wins, he loses. And I'm wondering, is the message here that she wanted out and she's gotten what she wanted? Why do you think he used that at that end of the line?
That's how I read it. We've had that feeling. Like, you feel like you're being left behind. You basically, they're gone off with somebody else or into a new life, and you're still stuck on this same old thing. You're stuck in a rut. You're stuck here. You've lost them, and you've lost your own sense of purpose.
Purpose, or maybe your identity.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's a kind of an interesting commentary that we do lose so much of ourselves when we're in love. And I think it's just a hint of bitterness. This is not a bitter song in the same way that I'm Not Supposed to Care is not a bitter song, that other songs that he've done, they're about love lost. Dreamland is another one that comes to mind, which we did earlier this season. But, you know, you win. And I think he just allows himself just a little bit of bitterness. And then he goes on with the brooding, or however you want to say it. Waiting for a line to fall, telling you it's all a big mistake. The only thing I could think of in terms of for a line to fall is in the context of songwriting. He's waiting for the inspiration. You know, this is how I want to express myself, and I'm looking for exactly the right phrase, the right sentence. Because he does say a little later on, but the words won't come. When he's talking about line, is he talking about songwriting? Is he talking about a telephone line? What do you think he means?
Well, I've always read that one myself as being the old term, drop a line. When I was thinking about the words for this, I looked up that expression. And in fact, it first shows up in English in 1647. And it's basically drop like a single line or just something very briefly to say, I'm okay, or, you know, whatever it could be. I still love you. You know, that could be the line that's being used. You know, you kind of just wish the phone is going to ring and someone's going to say, it's okay, everything's fine. That's how I've taken it.
Yeah, we're going to come back to that idea of, are things really okay? All I want is just to know that you're all right. And then it's all a big mistake. And it sounds like he's saying the mistake is hers as much as it is his. She's made a mistake in abandoning the relationship. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's probably a mutual thing there. Like maybe they've had a fight and it's just the whole thing's a mistake. Like that's how I've taken it. Not that the relationship was a mistake, but that maybe there's just been a misunderstanding and it's separated them.
Looking at a face so out of place inside that picture frame of lace, he's still got a picture of her on the wall or on his piano or something like that. To me, you talked about ruminating. I mean, this is really torturing yourself. If you've got this person's face and you're looking at it, and you know every time you look at it, you're going to feel worse. The tendency would be, I would think, okay, I'm going to take this off the wall. I'm going to put it face down. I'm going to put it in a drawer or someplace. I'm just going to get rid of it. But he's not doing that. And that goes along with, he can't even conjure up the energy or the wherewithal to move the picture out of the way.
I've been there, done that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as have I. For me, it was just a case of, okay, I'm just going to turn the picture over and not think about it. It didn't solve the problem, but at least it made me feel a little better.
We'll be back to our conversation with John McLaughlin about looking at the rain in just a minute. But first, a word from a podcast partner or two.
Hi, this is Audie Martello, the host of the Mostly Folk podcast, a 60-minute foray into the music we all love. You will hear newly released albums, classic folk, country, and bluegrass music, as well as some traditional music that may or may not be true to the genre. Sometimes irreverent, often opinionated, but always entertaining. You may even hear a radio magic trick every so often, as well as numerous interviews via Zoom and telephone with established as well as indie artists. Mostly Folk is available wherever you listen to podcasts and always at mostlyfolk.org.
Are you a fan of true crime, cults, conspiracies, and all things sinister? Then tune in with me, your host, Steph, every week for a new episode of the Sinister Story Hour. You can find the Sinister Story Hour on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Looking at the wall, wishing you'd call and tell me you're okay. That's all. I thought of the fact that the students I teach, most of them aren't aware of the fact that the telephone used to be on the wall, either because it was station there, or maybe it was on a counter or something like that. Nowadays, of course, we all have smartphones. So the wall, why would you look at the wall? The phone's in your pocket. Wishing that you'd call and tell me you're okay, that's all. But is that really all he wants, is just to know that she's okay? It sounds like what he really wants is for her to come back, not to say, hi, Gordon, I'm okay. Just wanted to tell you, bye.
Yeah. Well, and again, there he is, just kind of stuck. I think the looking at the wall with the old phone thing is a great way of looking at it. I hadn't even thought of that before, because I think part of it is just he's obsessed and stuck with the situation. He's just staring at the wall anyway. But yes, there we were. We had our phones were all on the wall in the past with those 48-foot cords that ran out. Yeah.
Those pigtail things that would get snarled up and you try to walk away and all of a sudden you realize you just pulled the phone onto the floor or something. Yeah. Boy, those were the days, weren't they? Wishing this was all a dream and I'd find you sleeping when I wake. Pretty straightforward there. wishing that he would wake up from this dream. He rolls over and there she is. I think, oh, whew, this was all just a bad dream.
Also, when I've referenced it to somebody who's died, if it was a partner or something that has gone, you wake up. I haven't experienced this myself in that way, but you'd wake up one wishing that they were just there. Like somehow this, oh, surely this is a dream. They aren't really gone. They'll be there when you wake up. I think there's that aspect to it too.
Yeah, I like the way you said that, that this is a real cliche, but you're in denial about it. And that is, we know, the first stage of grief is to deny that the event has happened or to deny that it's had the impact on you that it had. And I think we have all gone through that, even though we don't like to admit that we've gone through denial at some point. Looking at the trees, so ill at ease from sleep that will not come, that's me. Well, probably from sleep and probably too many cigarettes and too much coffee. Probably not booze, because booze will tend to put you to sleep, although we know that Gordon had started drinking kind of heavily by this time. But being at ease, probably sick to his stomach, definitely sleep deprived, and really feeling awful in all sorts of ways.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I also read this line that way personally, but also trees, which he's kind of equating himself to that. Trees don't sleep. They just stand there. They have to put up with all of this on and on. So I always played with that line, you know, trees so ill at ease from sleep that will not come. It's like for them, the sleep doesn't come. And that's how it feels when you're in this grief state. It just feels like sleep won't come. You'd love to, but you're just got to stand there and take it.
Maybe that's why he said at the very end, that's me, bringing it back to himself. I hadn't thought about the idea trees don't sleep. They are living beings, but of course they don't sleep, or certainly not in the way that human beings do or that animals do.
Yeah, I may be stretching it there in terms of my interpretation of it, but it's crossed my mind.
No, it's good personification. It's good. Looking at the dawn, knowing it's wrong, still thinking of your love that's gone. So on some level, he knows she's not coming back. And on some level, he knows, look, I really need to start the process of moving on. Stephen Stills wrote a great song called So Begins the Task. I must learn to live without you now. So at some point he's thinking to himself, Lightfoot is, look, this is over. I'm just not quite where I haven't put two and two together quite yet. And he's not doing himself any favors by brooding or ruminating, but yet here he is. As you said, he can't get unstuck.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's the crux of the song here. And it tells us, too, that it really is over. And he knows that, but he doesn't want to believe it.
Yeah, well said. But the words won't come. I know I'd feel the same looking at the rain. Great way of rounding out the song. And we have talked about the idea the words won't come. And yet I thought, Gord, you've just written this beautiful song. Okay, obviously the words did come. You know, you were able to express yourself so well. So I'm not really sure why he said that.
What if it's the words from his love that haven't come, like the other person, that those words haven't come? I don't know, but just a thought.
Yeah, okay, the words won't come from you, meaning right. his audience, the person that he's addressing this to. And then he'd feel the same as what?
Yeah, that is a mystery line.
That might have been just poetic license. I mean, I never think of Lightfoot as a particularly impatient man when it comes to the writing process and the recording process. But at that point, he may just have thought, okay, I just got to finish this off. So, you know, let's go ahead and stick that in. It scans. It's got a good meter to it. Let's just move on. I haven't found any commentaries about that Lightfoot has made about this song in particular. There may be some, but I haven't seen them.
No, me neither.
We should talk a little bit about the context that this was put in. The song was, as you say, on the Don Quixote album. It was 1972. That was the year I was born. It's his eighth original album. It was the fourth track on the record. It was not released as a single, which I kind of understand. But the album went to number one in Canada, 42 in the US, and 44 in the UK. And Lightfoot has not done particularly well in the UK by and large. Certainly after Endless Wire, I don't think anything that he did charted in the UK. So for him to make an impact on the British charts kind of says something.
Yeah, I think maybe right in that period, though, if some of the listeners may have heard the BBC 1971-72 recording, 71, I think it was, that he did. And featured songs off the previous album, Summerside of Life, and before. So I think he had a bit of a following, and then maybe that's why he still had some of that momentum there. But I don't think he toured a lot there after. He did some in the 60s, but then I think he didn't go there that often.
It's interesting because he has a great following around the English-speaking world, Canada, of course, and the States, and Australia and New Zealand. And this is something we've talked about in the Facebook groups to some extent, that he just hasn't had the same magnitude of impact in Britain. Maybe that's because he hasn't toured there, but in the timing that we're talking about right now, the BBC broadcast, people are saying, oh yeah, I think I'll listen to this, because he was just on the Tube, you know, not long ago. My favorite musical aspect of the song, I thought it was the strings for the longest time, okay, which Nick DeCaro did so beautifully, and he's worked on other Lightfoot songs. But I gotta say that the syncopated guitars that are sort of down in the mix, that sort of bum 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 ding 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 bum 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 ding ding, I don't know how to describe them. He did the same thing with the song Beautiful, which I think is also on this record. I gotta tell you, that's my favorite part of this, just because it's such a great syncopation of what's going on. So you put that together with the strings, and I'm just thinking, this is just a masterpiece. So, John, what's your favorite musical aspect of it?
Well, it is the way that the key works. And I'm just going to play a little sample here.
Of
the chord. So the song is in the key of D.
Mm-hmm.
And so your standard chords in there would be D and then the G and A. And it uses all of those. But the interesting thing is that he starts on the dominant chord, which is A. So if that this is the key we're in. So he starts on A, doing this rolling bass line, which is sort of over the verse, and then he comes in on the verse in the key of A, looking at the rain, which is really different to use. It's really not that normal to do a verse starting on the dominant chord. So that is very interesting. And then I love the chorus in it, which has the descending bass line. So it's A, G, F sharp, E. And then it rolls right around back into the verse again. And I think the musical aspect of it all actually mirrors the rumination, the can't get yourself out of a loop. Most songs have a chorus and a verse that are separate and feel different. This just rolls. I mean, you come out of the chorus and it just rolls straight back into the verse again, just like our own thoughts and as we go over it. And then the tag is also interesting, which is the but the words won't come part. And then he does end it with the looking at the rain, mm-hmm, back into the root chord. So finally, things actually resolve and go to the actual key of the song. Doesn't start that way, and the chorus rolls in a different way, but then it ends up there. It's almost like I've resolved myself to the situation.
Wow. You know, I hadn't thought about it in terms of the chord progression, because I have never sat down to play it, but I think about it now. That may have been the reason that the very first time I listened to it, I thought, this is leading me all sorts of different directions musically, and I wasn't sure where he was going with it. But the fact that he's starting on the tonic and then he goes into this run that you would think belongs in a different key, a key with three sharps rather than two sharps. For you music types out there, the three sharps would be the key of A rather than the key of D, which would be two sharps. Yeah, I mean, this really is a little different from a lot of the different folk and pop stuff that was coming out at the time. And that's probably the reason why it's been such a perennial for fans.
This song does have a chorus. He sings the first chorus and first and fourth, and he sings the other chorus twice in a row in the middle. But I've found, going over all of these songs from this time, including what follows up next to it, which is Old Dan's Records, that came out later in 72, he uses very few traditional choruses on his songs. And I think that's what gives him the interest to me. It's not the traditional verse, chorus, verse, chorus kind of a thing. Many of his songs don't actually have a chorus, or if he does have a chorus, he doesn't just repeat the same words over and over again in them. I think it adds a sophistication to him that sets him apart from a lot of other songwriters at the time. Not that I don't love other songwriters at the time, I certainly do, but just in terms of his style, I think it just gives him a different feel. And this song is similar to that in terms of how it is musically, starting on the verse in a not the dominant or the key of the song. It's just a different take. I love it.
You make a good point about the way he structures his songs. And I was just thinking, I've never looked at his lyrics from beginning to end, but there's very little of that traditional structure, which is, okay, you have a verse and then you come back to exactly the same chorus over and over again. And Lightfoot doesn't do that. Or if he does it musically, he doesn't do it lyrically. And that's probably one of the reasons why he caught the ear of so many people who loved folk music, but they weren't necessarily, they were listening to him and thinking, wait a second, he did something a little different. Well, that's kind of cool. And then, of course, his voice was just wonderful.
We'll be back to our conversation with John McLaughlin about Looking at the Rain in just a minute. But first, a word from a podcast partner or two.
The world at war. Two lives in the balance. Who will live to see another day? The leader of the free world or a man falsely accused of treason? In this new dramatic audio series, A Date with Death, Helen Meeker has to make that choice, and time is running out. Assigned to exposing an espionage ring operating on American and British soil, Helen must outwit bank robbers, avoid booby traps, and even have dinner with a dead man. When the date with death is over, who's picking up the check? Ace Collins' best-selling World War II novella, A Date with Death, comes to life in this production by the Long Highway Players. Available on Acast and coming soon to a podcast feed near you, A Date with Death is a proud member of the That's Not Canon podcast network.
Is that song really a cover? What instrument are they playing there? What do those crazy lyrics mean? If you're the kind of person who thinks about stuff like that, you're in luck because I've got just the podcast for you. How Good It Is chooses a single song each episode and takes a dive into the story behind the song and the artist who made it famous. I'm Claude Call. You can find me in your favorite podcast software or just point your browser to howgooditis.com. How good it is.
This is pretty much the standard group that he was with in the 60s and 70s. He was playing 6 and 12 string guitar on the album, although I don't hear any 12 string, just 6 string. Red, Terry, and Rick, and then Nick DiCaro was doing the string arrangements. I hear guitar and bass and strings. There's no percussion. I know Ry Cooter played mandolin on the album, but there's obviously no mandolin on this. The thing that I thought was interesting is that he's only played this song live one time in his entire career. And I think it would be because the strings added so much to it on the recording that to do it without the strings might make it a little bit stark. Now, you've recorded it, and I'm sure that you've played it in your live shows. But I'm wondering, why do you think Lightfoot hasn't done it more? Is it a musical reason, or do you think it might be a more personal reason?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, it has been done at some point way back then, but it just didn't show up on the set list and so on. I don't remember hearing it. My first concert was 1973, and I don't remember him playing it there, but I don't remember all the songs from that show either. It is a few years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I mean, when I became a guitar playing fan of Lightfoot, I watched a lot when in his concerts, what keys he played in. And interestingly, this song, he capos on the first fret of the guitar, and as far as I know, never capoed on the first fret on his guitar in live performances. He's always on the second or the third fret. I know he didn't like to change keys or have to read tune during shows, so he was very, very cognizant of keeping songs on the second fret. If he did have to move it in the same set, he would only do it once. He was very, very conscious of that. His guitar was in tune, and it was great. So I often wonder whether this song was just in the wrong key for him, for his voice, even going up a semitone to the second fret. And maybe it just didn't feel right to play live. This song and the one that follows it, which is Ordinary Man, are two that he plays on the first fret. And I don't ever remember hearing either of those in any live performance.
Well, it brings up another musical thing for us guitar players. I've heard that Lightfoot always uses a capo. I mean, he never plays any song without using a capo, no matter what fret you're talking about. He always, always, always uses a capo. And that may be because to tune a 12 string in the best of circumstances is a challenge.
Yeah.
And so maybe he just feels, okay, well, I know it'll be in tune if I just keep the capo on the first fret or something like that. So is that just mythology, or is that actually true that he always uses a capo for all of his performances?
I have never seen him play without a capo on. And I don't think any of his recordings he did either. It just suited his voice for that. And so all of his, so much of this stuff, is just second or third fret. And yeah, moving a capo on a 12 string in the middle of a performance would be a no-no. So he rarely did that. He would do second fret songs on his 12 string in the first set, for example, like Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. In the second set, he would do ones on the third fret, the Canadian Railroad Trilogy or Early Morning Rain, although that one he played in both places. So he would never switch in the middle of a thing. Sometimes with a six string, he would. But a six string, as you know, is an awful lot easier to tune when you move a capo around than...
Oh, yeah. And you talked about the idea of not wanting to tune in the middle of a concert. When I'm in performance, and I'm sure this may be true for you too, I don't like having to tune because I realize that that is the audience's time. They're going to get distracted, or they're going to get bored, or they're going to say, come on, come on, come on. This is not what we paid for. And when I've used 12 strings in performance, I've just kind of seen, please, God, don't let this thing go out of tune, because it's going to take forever to get this thing retuned. And a 12 string is such that if you have one string out of the 12 that's just a little bit out, you've destroyed the entire instrument. I mean, it's just going to sound awful.
Absolutely. Well, he always joked about the belligerent Bs. The B string on a 12 string is really difficult to get. The two B strings, the second string, or the third and the fourth technically strings on there. So that was always a thing. And but he never did move his capo during the set that I remember.
Yeah. And that was a very wise decision. Now, there have been five official covers. One was yours, John. Barbara J., whose I think real name is Barbara Williams. We're going to have her on the show later this season. That's going to be fun. Hank Williams Jr., Joel Dennis, and then this one blew my mind. Eric Clapton covered this song. Yeah. And Gordon's is better, but I thought it was kind of interesting that of all people, Clapton, who up until the 90s was not known as an acoustic player at all, does this song and does an admirable cover of it. And this is something I'm going to have to research a little bit. Hey, Eric, why did you choose to do that song in that way? Is there anybody that you kind of wish had done this, or that you wish would do it?
Well, weirdly enough, I wouldn't have said this years ago, but as I get older, I appreciate even more Frank Sinatra, because his phrasing is impeccable. He can phrase anything any way he wants, and he's great at sort of the more intimate sound of something. So I can hear with this one, you talked earlier about the strings that are in this song, but I could hear Frank Sinatra with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra in the CBS studio do this massive orchestra behind him doing Looking at the Rain. He would phrase it so amazingly that would be really different from what one would expect. I know he's not current, but that would be my dream one just for fun.
Oh gosh. Harry Connick Jr. might also be able to take a shot at it. Tony Bennett, although I don't know how much longer he's going to be around. And I don't know if he's doing recordings, but that same kind of ilk, you know, just vocalists. The ones that I chose were a little bit more contemporary. I would love to hear David Crosby do this. Although, again, he also is getting on in years. And then Stevie Nicks, I think, could do an okay job with this.
For sure.
Because she's certainly done things like Landslide and things that were acoustic-based when she was in Fleetwood Mac. So that would have been good. Are there any other closing thoughts on this song, John, before I find out a little bit more about what's been happening with you?
No, this is one of my top five favorite Lightfoot songs. And it's interesting because it's really a fairly obscure album cut, as they say. And it's a case where back in the day, we bought the album, we listened over and over and over again. And probably nowadays, you would miss a lot of songs like this because so much selection out there. So it was kind of interesting. It just feels embedded into me, and it means a lot to me. So I've nothing more than that. Truly love playing it.
So what have you been up to musically? Now, you were on the show about 18 months ago when we first started out. I think you were in episode 2 or episode 3. And we were coming out of the pandemic and all that. And so what have you been doing musically, and what should the listeners out there, particularly ones in British Columbia, know about your musical activities?
Well, actually, I'm doing a show that features Gordon Lightfoot's music, the whole show, and I've got a little tour coming up next April, but it's in British Columbia in sort of a few soft cedars. That'll be really fun to do. I don't do his songs purposely exactly like him. Some of them are close, but I try to do things just to make them more my own. So I'm doing that. But I'm also starting a series. It's a bold plan. It sounds like it's as bold as your plan of doing this podcast, but it will be a video version, just a song. I'm going to record each of his songs starting at the beginning and put them on YouTube. So, and I'll, wow. I'll probably work with my lead guitarist, Mark Atkinson. And I'll just talk about what that song means to me and how we're playing it. So it'll be a quick video of each song. And I'm going to start that up in January on my YouTube channel.
So that's going to start with Rich Man Spiritual and go all the way through everything on solo.
Well, I figure even if I could get up to the 80s, but that would be 160 songs to do. So it's a bit of it's a bit of work, but it's fun. So. It's getting back to these songs and looking at them as actually playing them is quite interesting. Like, it's a different thing, and I'm trying to make them things that mean something to me to do them, or the character that might be singing them, or whatever. It's just really interesting. And then, of course, when I listen to your podcast and we're talking about these songs, you know, you start to remember the times, what else was going on. And some of it, I mean, Rich Man Spiritual, the first album, I was only 6 years old. So it's not like I remembered too much. I didn't remember anything of it then. But then you kind of dig into it, and it's quite interesting.
You know that, you know, my exposure to Lightfoot happened in 75 when I was 3 years old. And I didn't understand the depth of what he was doing. I just knew that it was catchy, and it was unlike anything that anybody else was listening to in my peer group. So, John, where can people find you online?
My website is johnmclaughlin.ca. And if you're wondering how to spell McLaughlin, look up Sarah McLaughlin, the singer, and it's spelled exactly like hers is, except that I'm not related.
That was my next question, because I think you probably would have made that clear by now. John McLaughlin, thank you so much. It's great to see you again. Good to talk with you. And I hope to have you back on the show soon, and maybe on the webcast we're going to be doing for people to do an online tribute concert.
Ah, cool. I'd love to. Thanks, Mike.
And thanks for listening, everybody. If you like this well enough to listen to the whole thing, tell somebody about it. Carefree Highway Revisited is on Apple, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your listening matter. Our website is www.lightfootpodcast.com. I'd like to make a special request for you to visit my Patreon page. I love this show so much, and I want to keep it going, and you're in a position to help. Please head over to www.patreon.com/carefreehighwayrevisited. A dollar or two a month is all I ask. You can reach me, Mike Messner, at teachermike72@gmail.com.
Our next episode will feature my guest, Jeff Coast. He'll be making his second appearance on the podcast, and he'll be talking about Gordon's song, Is There Anyone Home, from Sundown. That'll be coming up in the last week of November. Until then, this is Mike Messner reminding you, run for the roses, but don't forget to stop and smell them. We'll see you next time.